As you know, it's often said that the journey is just as much fun and it's just as exciting as the destination itself. And in Rosetta's case, that is certainly true. So we've got a bit of time, so let's take a moment to look at some of the highlights since Rosetta's launch back in 2004. Years ago in Kourou, French Guiana, the Rosetta spacecraft set off on a breathtaking mission to rendezvous with a comet. In order to reach its target, Rosetta played a game of cosmic pool with two of the planets in our solar system. It swung by the Earth three times and once around Mars for a gravitational push on its long journey. In 2008, Rosetta imaged asteroid Steins, one of the millions of asteroids orbiting the Sun between Mars and Jupiter. Steins revealed itself to be a diamond-shaped rock covered in impact craters. In 2010, Rosetta met up with a different asteroid, Lutetia, believed to be around 4.5 billion years old, a remnant from when the solar system was formed. Covered in grooves, fractures and fault lines, one of its 350 craters stretches for 57 kilometres, the remains of a dramatic collision. Its composition also hints at a metallic core. After entering deep space, the spacecraft put all but essential operations into temporary hibernation in June 2011. Rosetta builds on the legacy of Giotto, ESA's first deep space mission and the first to chase a comet. Giotto made history as part of an international fleet of five spacecraft when it approached Halley's Comet in 1985. It got within 600 kilometres, producing a number of spectacular images, including close-ups of the comet's nucleus. Rosetta will go even closer to a comet, orbiting a comet for the first time and landing on its surface.
Well, I've landed now in what is known as the briefing room, just outside the main control room, in order to talk a bit more with the mission's scientists. And I would like to start with the one right next to me, Holger Zirks, principal investigator of OSIRIS. It's a 35-kilogram, 4-megapixel camera on board of Rosetta. And Holger, it's good to see you again. You were talking to me back in January when you promised me that this wonderful camera will provide us with fantastic high-resolution, astonishing resolution images. Has OSIRIS delivered?
Yes, it did. So we turned on the instrument on the 20th of March and our target comet was still sub-pixel. So it took us up to 16th of June to fill one single pixel of our sensor with the comet. Mm-hmm. And it took us another month up to 14th of July really to get something like 20 pixel across on our sensor, which is something like two hairs filled filled with pixel of the nucleus. So what I'm showing here is a rotational movie. So this is what we typically take. So 10 degrees of rotation, one image of the nucleus, and work then into a rotational movie here. So you see processed and the unprocessed raw data here. This is really pixel by pixel as coming down from Rosetta. From this, we can work a shape model. And so this was taken a few days later and worked into the first shape, and it was just so exciting.
And what he's showing us now is a hull shape, basically two body. Lumps so we stuck together. From the light curve, in some aspects, it looks like a duck.
It's got a lot of nicknames already because of that.
Lots of nicknames. It looks bilo. We don't know if it's a contact binary or is it carved like this by activity. And it's so amazing to see this made of a 30 pixel across image sequence to see this wonderful shape model coming up. So and then So now, so coming closer, it took a long stretch of time to see high-res resolution images. So it took really long. So this was coming down this weekend, and we released it. It was not even made for surfaced. This is one image taken out of a dust search sequence. It has some stuff on there, so it's a bit overexposed. It has blemishes, but it's really great stuff to see structure coming up mm-hmm. on the surface, so real topography, so bright spots, darker spots, and real stuff now in high res, what we thought this weekend. But it's first of all, it's not all about the nucleus. So we also see activity. So we have seen the surprising outburst on 30th of April, so going up and then decaying in 2 weeks of time, and it was gone, so back to baseline. Now, being close, this is an image taken with a wide-angle camera, so on Sunday, so heavily overexposed, so the nucleus overexposed 100 times, such that we can
see... So what we can see now is a traditional comet-type photo with a big fuzzy blob in the middle and a tail and, stretching off.
So, but then... We want to go back to the nucleus. You want to see the nucleus. And here it goes. So this is an image coming down on, taken on 3rd of August, coming down on 4th. This here we are talking 5.5 meters pixel resolution, and it's the best comet nucleus ever resolved in space. So we see lots of structures, so the bilobe structures, the deep bite, so about 1,000 meters deep. We see a big depression here on the head of it. We see the brightness variation across surface. Cliffs about 150 meters high. And imagine this is a rubble pile, like ashes or so. So it's a porous. So how can this work this way by outgassing, by shaping throughout orbit? We also see smooth areas, planes coming up. But it is not only this shot. It also has a backside. Woof. So this is the backside, and we resolve boulders. So these are boulders of house size, 10 meters size, and bigger. And they also vary in brightness. We'll have to understand why and what it is really made of. Also very sharp edges. And, this is what we got by yesterday, and we are getting
there's
more
images.
There's more to come today. It's just streaming down, and we'll work it this afternoon and hope for the best to show more.
So now we have a really good idea already what 67P really looks like, and you will have even more beauty shots for us later this afternoon. Before I let you go, just briefly, back in January, you told me that the comet is important to you because it is a story about us. What does this comet, so far from what you've seen, tell you about us, about you?
Well, it will it will be the key in cometary science, and it's the beginning of a story of learning about so where did it form, what does it tell us about the water we are, and the early solar system. So there is a story to come. We are just beginning to build it up, to go with this story.
Well, thank you so much, Holger, for sharing these wonderful images with us. I will now ask two other scientists here with while you're setting it up kindly enough for us. Thank you very much, Holger Sirks. And next to me right now is the next scientist already, who is eager to tell us about his findings, Fabrizio Capaccioni. He is the PI of VIRTIS. And VIRTIS stands for Visible and Infrared Thermal Imaging Spectrometer. It's divided into two channels, mapping channel and high resolution channel. Just briefly, what do we have to think about that?
Yeah. Okay, yes. As you said, we have two channels. The mapping channels is like a camera, like Holger's camera, but with a lower resolution, but it has the capability of observing in more than the usual three colors of a photographic camera. It covers the full spectrum in 860 colors, covering the spectrum from the ultraviolet to the thermal. And that will be used essentially to study the nucleus and to study the composition of the nucleus and the thermal emission, so the temperature and thermal properties. VIRTIS-H, the high-resolution channel, instead is a point spectrometer. It's not able to produce images, but gives a fine resolution on the coma gases. So it will allow to determine the gas distribution, the gas production rate, and so on.
And Fabrizio, I can just see that we have an image here, so probably it's easier for everyone if you switch to this side. What are we seeing here exactly?
Yes, this is an image which has been taken on the 29th of July last week, and this covering is an animation that covers the full rotation of the nucleus, and the image in two spectral bands, the 1.4 micron, which is in the reflectance region, and the 5 micron, which is in the thermal emission region. And from the thermal emission, we were able to measure the temperature. Below there is a graph which shows the behavior of the temperature as the comet rotates. On top, there is also the Shame model rendering, that just to give the idea of how this object is taken during the rotation. And we were surprised to see this large temperature on the surface. So we see that there is a variation with the rotation, and we have a maximum temperature, which is around 220 K.
So if I measure the temperature with a human being normally, it's about finding out if he's well. When you say you're surprised about this temperature, does this tell you anything about the comet being well, not well, something unusual?
Well, it tells us already some information on the structure of the surface, of at least the first centimeters of the surface, which is saying, in fact, that from this maximum temperature, I repeat again, this is a maximum temperature, it's not the average, tells us that the crust is porous, does not contain too much ice, but of course we see ice, we see water coming out, so there must be a way to come out for the water. But from these measurements, the maximum temperature is associated to a crust which is porous, dusty, and with no ice.
Okay. And temperature, of course, Fabrizio, thank you. And don't go away, because you will help Sam now as well. Sam Gulkis, who's standing next to me, and you're in charge of Miro. And temperature measuring is also very big for you. Come a bit closer so we can see you in the light as well. Miro stands for Microwave Instrument for the Rosetta Orbiter. But we're not talking about a microwave here. We're actually talking about a radio telescope. What exactly is it? Who's behind it?
Yes, may I move over next to the screen?
You can, of course.
Yes, so MIRO stands for Microwave Instrument for the Rosetta Orbiter, and it's basically a very small radio telescope, and we make up for size, for the small size, in being really close to the comet now. So, we have very good resolution with the instrument. And just because it's small doesn't mean that it doesn't have really extreme capabilities.
One of the really extreme capabilities, I think you took a measurement. You started in June, but you got a really, really good data in July. I think the next chart will show us something very interesting about the comet's coma.
Yes, I was going to just say, one comment, and that is this is the Ferrari of an instrument. This is not an Opel or a Fiat. It has a very high resolution capability, and one of the things that it does really well is it measures water around the comet. And the next slide that I will show you here will show what the water looks like to this instrument.
And there it is.
So here's a spectrum of water taken with the MIRO instrument. Mm-hmm. We first measured water in the comet in early June, and we have been tracking it ever since. There's a lot of information in this spectrum. If you look at it very closely, one of the things that you'll see is that the spectrum is not centered on zero. So the spacecraft is moving relative to the comet, and we have removed that Doppler shift from it and shifted it all back to where the water would be if we were looking at it in the laboratory. So if you look at it here, you'll notice that the spectrum is shifted.
I'll need you for the microphone. We have to keep it brief now.
Yes. So we're shifted over here into the negative side, and that means that we're seeing the gas from the comet rushing toward us.
Mm-hmm.
But the spectrum is also interested in what it doesn't show. You'll see that on this side of the spectrum, on the plus side, there's nothing. And that means that on the dark side of the comet, there is very little gas.
And all of this you found out in this very brief period of time, so there's lots more to come. Sam, Fabrizio, Holger, thank you very much. I'm afraid we have to leave it at this point, but talking about instruments on board of Rosetta, and of course waking up the orbiter, that took a long time, especially with all these instruments on board. You had to go step by step, but once it was awake, once it was up and running, these instruments could start to get down to work. So here's a look at some of the achievements Rosetta has performed since January.
Within 6 weeks of Rosetta's wake-up call, all of its 21 onboard instruments had been activated. The OSIRIS camera was the first remote sensing instrument to wake up for checking and operation. Without images from Rosetta, many scientists wouldn't be able to interpret the data from the comet, so it plays a key role in understanding the science. This was the first image of the comet from OSIRIS in 2011. Since then, it has been collecting more information, pixel by pixel, about the comet's rotation and shape, producing surprises along the way. Together with images from the navigation camera, this information will help mission controllers at the European Space Operations Centre in Germany to make orbital correction manoeuvres. Many instruments have been taking measurements since Rosetta was launched, including Rosina, which measures material and gases coming off a comet.
We did already a lot of measurements during the last 10 years. We see all of the spacecraft dirt coming off. So our instruments work perfectly. They are extremely sensitive, and I look very much forward to finally see the comet and not only the spacecraft with our instruments.
The orbiter's miniaturized microwave instrument, MIRO, has also been in action. Built by an international team, it's the first instrument of its kind to have flown to the outer edges of our solar system. And during flybys of asteroids Steins and Lutetia, it took temperature measurements. From late May, MIRO turned its attention to the comet Nucleus, measuring gases that are released as the comet approaches the Sun. In early June, MIRO made the first observations of water vapour streaming away from the comet, equivalent to two small glasses of water every second. But Rosetta's science has only just begun.
You're on Southern FM.
Now, in order to help Rosetta to continue with its scientific mission, a highly complex maneuver is necessary today. Frank Butnik is back with us again, flight dynamics expert. And you can tell us a bit more about this maneuver. Now, when we're talking about Rosetta going into orbit, it's not your usual orbit, is it?
Yeah, okay, it's not what we don't do today. We don't go into orbit around the comet today. And the reason for that is we don't know the comet or the physical properties of the comet sufficiently now. So what we want to do is we stay, let's say, close to the comet, and we fly next to the comet. If you see it from a solar system point of view, they're just flying next to each other, with Rosetta being closer to the Sun and the comet being behind, such that the Sun always illuminates more or less the full nucleus of the comet so that they can see it with our navigation camera. This is what we want to do. And we stay 100 kilometers apart. And then we have a very small relative velocity, so we drift a little bit away. And when we drift away after a while, so after 3 or 4 days, we do a very small maneuver, less than a meter per second, to go back a bit, going up again. And we fly, and both flying around the Sun simultaneously, 100 kilometer distance. And then after 4 days again, another maneuver. So this makes this kind of triangle, which we fly in front of the comet as seen from the Sun.
So it's a very timid rendezvous, let's say, with Rosetta sort of tiptoeing around the comet on one side. But you said right now we have to do this because we don't know enough about the comet. But why has this orbit been chosen?
Yeah, okay. First of all, we want to characterize the comet, how it rotates, measure its mass, identify landmarks on it, and we have to see it fully illuminated. And with 100 kilometer distance and with this orbit, we see, let's say, the full nucleus in the field of view of the navigation camera. This is one goal. And the other goal is we see it slightly with different phase angles, so different angle illumination angles from the sun. And then we see areas with shadows and without shadows, and this we can characterize landmarks very well. And also, this motion which we have 100 kilometer distance is a bit bended. Yeah, it's not a linear motion, so the Rosetta is bended a bit, and this bending is what we are using. Let's say this bending comes from the gravity attraction from the center.
So there is gravity.
There is gravity. Of course, there is gravity, but we don't know what the mass is, so we don't know how big it is. And this we need to know before we go into an orbit, in a controlled orbit around the comet. So we use this bending of the trajectory, we measure this to get hold on the mass of the comet. This is what we need to know initially now to go further down and to go into orbit finally around the comet.
Exactly, which will happen later this year. Well, Frank, thank you very much for your explanation. We're talking about this comet, and of course Rosetta has been spending 10 years to chase it, but believe it or not, 50 years ago we didn't even know that this comet existed at all. It was in 1969 when two astronomers in Ukraine, going by the names Churyumov Gerasimenko, spotted this comet, giving it this rather complicated name, at least for me, which is why it's also dubbed 67P. And this is what we know about the comet and why it is important to study it.
Like its name, Comet 67P, Churyumov-Gerasimenko, is in two parts. It's a so-called binary comet, and pixelated images from Rosetta's Sirius camera in July also showed that it is shaped like a duck. Around 3 by 5 kilometers in size, it rotates every 12 hours and 24 minutes. Comet 67P is known as a Jupiter family comet because Jupiter's gravity controls the comet's orbit around the Sun. Some of these icy space rocks are ejected by collisions or gravitational changes and become comets. One theory suggests that binary comets are formed when two comets collide, melded together when the solar system was formed. Studying Comet 67P will give insights into its origins and activity.
A comet is—it's not a static animal. It really develops with time. The nucleus sits there, but then the outgassing, the gas coming out of it, that just increases as we come closer to the sun. When the comet is heated by the solar radiation, that's when the gas starts pouring out, and that gives the cloud you see around the comet. And that is in that cloud is what we will measure.
Water can be found as a vapor in the halo or coma around a comet nucleus and in its tail, and in ice form in the nucleus itself. Scientists want to study how water sublimates on the comet, going from a solid to a gas without the liquid phase. Its tail is a comet's distinctive feature, and a comet can have up to three of them, made from dust, ions, or plasma.
It's the so-called fourth state of matter. We use to solids, liquids and gases, while plasma is the fourth state of matter. And what we're trying to do is to study plasma in the environment of the comet.
Comet 67P's two parts and complex shape will offer unique challenges to the mission. But studying comets will shed light on the emergence of water and life on Earth, and also inform us about the formation of our solar system.
On the space show, we're broadcasting from the German Space Operations Center.
The maneuver started, and Sylvain Loudio has been watching the screen. What's the status?
Well, we have the telemetry back, and I can confirm the maneuver has just started nominally. All looks good.
Brilliant. Congratulations to that, first of all. But you still keep watching the screens, because for the next few minutes, there's still a lot of information that we're looking for. What exactly are we looking at here?
You can see here that the chamber temperatures of the spacecraft have started. They were at 20 degrees. You can see them peaking up. They'll go up to 110 degrees. So this is all nominal right now. And you can see rates on the spacecraft starting to build up. I mean, it's quite tough for the spacecraft to do these maneuvers, so all looks good.
All looks good. So basically, we don't need to worry right now. You keep an eye on this now, Sylvain. I would like to talk to your colleague, Andrea Accomazzo, who I know is a man with nerves of steel. But I'll get back to you again when you can tell us really today's mission is accomplished, which is still...
It has taken 22 minutes for that radio signal to arrive from the comet.
From the big January Rosetta, wake up. Andrea Komatz, of course, is Rosetta's mission director. And when I said nerves of steel, it took a bit longer. It took a bit longer in January to have you smile and say, yep, everything is nominal.
Well, it was definitely a totally different event. We had abandoned the spacecraft for more than 2 years, and we hadn't no contact at all. We were desperately waiting for that contact. Here is totally different emotions today.
When Sylvain is smiling, the commands, I believe, were given in the last past days, the last command yesterday. Is there still a challenge right now at this moment?
Well, the spacecraft still has to do the maneuver. As Frank described before, we still have to map this object. So we have to perform this small maneuver to gently drift around it as we want to map it properly. It's clear that the spacecraft has to work and is programmed to do this. So we are waiting for this result today.
Okay, so you've done your job for the time being. Now it's down to Rosetta. What if, and I'm not saying it will, but what if Rosetta does not perform the maneuver now? Try again or game over? What's the situation there?
No, it's definitely not game over. We have finished our approach phase to the comet. We are there. We are drifting with a very slow, very small relative velocity, so there's no chance that we are going to miss the comet. In case anything goes wrong, we will drift a bit. It will take a few days for us to eventually to come back, but we can do it now. Now there's no doubt that we are there.
And once it worked, now the signal, the first one that we just got, where does it come from? How does that work?
Currently, we're receiving the signal from our New Norcia station, which is in Australia, so it's doing quite a long travel through the solar system, and also on the Earth, it has to travel a few thousand kilometers before it gets into ESOC here.
And what are the next steps? Because we're waiting now a few minutes before Sylvain can tell us, and we keep an eye on the screens with him in just a moment. But what exactly is happening in these minutes? What are we waiting for?
Well, the maneuver will take, roughly speaking, a bit less than 7 minutes to perform this change on velocity of speed of the spacecraft. Once we have get the signal, we know that we have inserted the spacecraft onto the trajectory we need to fly, and it will mark a milestone in the project. This is the end of 10 years interplanetary flight. It's like driving on a motorway high speed, and what you start doing today is like entering a chaotic town with a lot of traffic where the signs are confusing. It is what we have to navigate now from.
Okay, then let's just get a taste of your and Sylvain's and everybody's work here in the main control room, which is part of just keeping an eye on the screens and see what happens, and then wait for Sylvain saying mission accomplished. Thank you very much, Andrea, for the moment.
This is Southern FM, the space show. We're broadcasting live from the German Space Operations Center. It's now 26 minutes since that burn started. Of course, that's taken about 21 minutes to arrive here for that signal. And Rosetta at the moment is 404 million kilometers away from the Earth, and it's 538 million kilometers from the Sun. It has traveled 6.4 billion kilometers, and the speed of the comet in orbit around the Sun is 15.38 kilometers per second. Now, at the moment, the people are watching the data coming in from that burn. As I say, the burn's actually finished now, but we won't know about it for several more minutes. And the signal, as I said, coming in via Australia and then on to the European Operations Centre. Now, just a reminder that a comet is a ball of ices and dust that orbits the Sun. And these balls vary in size from several hundred meters up to 10 or more kilometers. The ices are mostly water, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and methane. The orbits of comets are quite varied. Some come closer to the Sun than the planet Mercury, while others come no closer than the outer planets. The orbits of some comets go out beyond Mercury, others go out to the Oort cloud, nearly a light year from the Sun. Now, as a comet nears perihelion, that's its closest pass near the Sun, increasing warmth from the Sun causes surface ices to sublimate into gases. And these gases escape into space, or into the space surrounding the comet. The escaping gas carries tiny dust particles off the comet's icy nucleus. And this expanding shell of gases and dust is called a coma. It may expand up to 1 million kilometers across. It is this coma that we see as the comet. eventually pressure from solar radiation and the solar wind causes the coma to stream out away from the sun. This is the tail that we see pointing away from the coma. As the comet moves away from the sun, heading toward its aphelion, the nucleus cools and the activity fades away. The coma and tail disperse into invisibility. And they're applauding.
Say the famous words, please.
We're at the comet.
Yes. Hi, we're there. Yay.
Fantastic. Congratulations. Andrea, just quick, briefly for a moment, the two of you here right now. You just mentioned, you just said you never got it that clearly that Rosetta must be under pressure performing for us. How do you explain such a clear signal? Is that just luck today?
Well, I don't know. We've never seen the temperature of the thruster going so clean and so smoothly as today. So it's a fantastic result. Couldn't have been better. Now let's check the detailed performance of the maneuver offline.
Okay, so Sylvain, you can't go back to sleep now. Now the work begins, correct?
Exactly. And yeah, Rosetta was looking at us, knew we were looking at her, so this is why she did it for us.
Brilliant. Well, you deserve it. Congratulations. Congratulations to everyone here and people over there already hugging as well. But before I hand over to all those happy people, we have another little video for you, because obviously Rosetta has produced some surprises already, like the best or the clearest signal just now as well. And now that we're finally arrived at the comet, close to it at least, there'll be more surprises to come, I'm sure. So here's a look at some of the science that we can expect in the weeks and months to come.
Rosetta is a scientific mission to understand the origin and evolution of the solar system. The 21 onboard instruments include sensors, spectrometers, and cameras. Powered by solar panels that span 32 metres tip to tip, Rosetta is the first mission to completely rely on its solar cells for power beyond the main asteroid belt. These solar arrays, together with the antenna, must always point towards the Sun and the Earth. Located on the side of the spacecraft that will permanently face the comet are the instruments, such as the Atomic Force Microscope, MIDAS.
This is a very special type of microscope that is able to make very detailed three-dimensional images of objects that we collect. So our aim is to collect dust particles, and then we build very high-resolution three-dimensional images of these dust particles.
Studying dust grains helps provide a bigger picture, since many scientists believe these particles slowly coalesce to produce the building blocks of our solar system. The first dust particles are expected to be collected within weeks of arriving at the comet. The 11 orbiter instruments also include CONCERT. This is in two parts, one part on the orbiter, another on the lander. And together they will provide an insight into the comet's nucleus.
This will be done by transmitting the radio wave through the comet. This transmission will take place between orbiter and lander. And from this, from the signal transmitted through the comet, we will determine the properties of the interior.
CONCERT will operate during the descent of the Philae lander to the comet's surface, examining its density and structure. The 10 lander instruments will measure everything from the comet's magnetic field to the mechanical properties of the soil. As the lander remains busy in one place, the orbiter will spend the next 18 months examining the comet from every angle, until this unique and groundbreaking mission ends in December 2015.
This is the Space Show, broadcasting live from Germany.
The gentleman here next to me certainly looking forward to all the data and the findings that Rosetta will deliver in those 18 months. Mark McCorgran, he is the senior advisor to ESA's Science Directorate. And Mark, I remember we were standing here also in January, and I was told that you're the man who likes to ask the big questions. Now we're close to the comet. What kind of questions will those be?
First, what a wonderful moment, right? I mean, we're there, we've arrived. 10 years we've been in the car waiting to get to scientific Disneyland. And, you know, we haven't even got out of the car yet and look at what's outside the window. So it's just astonishing. You know, the really big questions here are, where do we come from? Where does this solar system we live in come from? How was it put together? How was it assembled? And then how did the planets get built up individually? And how did water get to this planet which we live on? And maybe even the questions about where the complex molecules, the organic molecules, which build us up. So water and life. I mean, these are questions which motivate everybody. And I think, you know, Rosetta is indeed the Rosetta Stone as a mission. It will unlock this treasure chest as a clue to all comets, many comets in our solar system. There are trillions out there. But this is a baseline. This is the one we can now study in such detail. We can rewrite history and begin to understand our own history. And I think that's, you know, a great thing for us. You know, scientific Disneyland, the big roller coaster awaits us in November. You know, that's the scary ride to go on. But we have all the other fun rides all the way through till next year. So we have a really great mission ahead of us. The end of this year is going to be frantic. The whole of next year is going to be thrilling. So it's a wonderful moment.
It's a wonderful moment indeed. We now know what the comet looks like from the outside. Now we're about to explore what it has in store for us inside and much, much more. Mark, thank you very much, because I see behind you some gentlemen who I'm sure are more than happy that this maneuver just now worked so well with such a clean signal, as we found out. Of course, ESA Director General Jean-Jacques Dordain, and with him, Professor Alvaro Jimenez, ESA Director of Science and Robotic Exploration. First of all, gentlemen, give us your broadest smile.
Oh, it's very easy, because I have lived a lot of events here in this very room, but each one is even better than the previous one. I think that it's fantastic. I think that when you imagine the sum of expertise which is behind that, because it looks easy, but it looks easy because there is a fantastic sum of expertise. When you see the enthusiasm of each individual, and when you listen to the different English accent, including from the English ones, you can say that I can say that ESA is a fantastic place to be and to work for. And I would like to thank very much, obviously, the member states for their support, industry for their fantastic spacecraft, and my colleagues. There are four generations of drivers here behind me, and they are all great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And Professor Jimenez, how important is today's mission accomplished for the whole mission, and especially, of course, for the science part?
Yes, today is very important because we get there, of course, and we have been working a lot just to get to this moment and prepare to analyze, to get close to the comet and to be able to understand it. I had actually prepared. We had a 3D printing of what we thought the comet was like, 67P, and I was going to unveil that. And I don't know if we can show that.
So they're moving over towards the comet. He's holding a model.
How we thought that the comet was 1 week ago. So it's a model of it.
It
now,
like
with
duck.
The images we are seeing today, it's impressive. It's fascinating. It doesn't look like. So it is the core of exploration, because we are going to places we have never been. And all what we can model is nothing compared to reality. Reality is much more fascinating. And we are getting, of course, we go there to get answers to some of our questions in science, like questions about the origin of the solar system, the origin of water on Earth, the origin of complex molecules on Earth. But what we are really interested in, not only in the answers, we are really, as scientists, interested in the questions. We are getting many more questions than answers, and the new questions are fascinating and opening a new world of exploration and science for the coming decades.
Absolutely, and as you just show us this beautiful model, now that we have those gorgeous pictures from OSIRIS, and there'll be even better ones coming later today and in the coming days, soon you'll be doing a new model. It's a bit like unwrapping a Christmas present with each layer, isn't it?
It's like a picture being developed. I mean, it goes with the time, it gets more resolution, it gets better, and we learn a lot. For example, today we know now about the temperature and what is the effect. I mean, it's not like comets used to be called as just ice rocks or dirty rocks. Now, this may be more dirty than ice, actually, with more. And this we didn't know. Now we see a lot of things that we will have to see what is the implication of this and how this is this comet came into this configuration.
Well, Professor Jiménez, Jean-Jacques Dehondin, we look very much forward to all the new findings, the new models, the new science that will come. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is Christmas every day.
This is Christmas every day. Beautiful last words. Thank you very much. And well, this wraps up our special coverage of this Rosetta meets the comet rendezvous. Today's mission has been accomplished, but of course there are many more to come, so do keep an eye on this spot. For now, from me and the whole team here at ESOC, it's bye-bye and hopefully see you soon.
And we've been broadcasting live from the European Space Operations Centre in Darmstadt, Germany.
Downstairs in the press center at 1 o'clock. So please.
Okay, now they're going into the ceremonies still, and they're going to be taking a lunch break very shortly, and then they're going to come back later. But by that time, we will be off air because at 8 o'clock we have a wonderful program called Purple Haze, the music until 10 o'clock. Yes, here on 88.3 Southern FM. Now we've got just a few station announcements to make, and then we'll be back talking more about the comet
reaching out to your community. The Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
For more information about the station that rocks your nation, check out www.southernfm.com.au.
Make sure you're tuning in this Saturday afternoon for the big SFL match of the day between Oakley Districts and Sky at Princess Highway Reserve, Oakley. 2 p.m. on 88.3 Southern FM, where the locals are the legends.
Open across the weekend, Lucky 13 Garage starting Fridays at 9 p.m. with quality local rock bands to Saturdays from 7:30 with the best live local, interstate and international rockabilly, rock and roll and cover bands that you're likely to see in Melbourne. Winding up Sunday afternoons from 3 p.m. with some of the best classic Aussie pop rock you're likely to come across. Lucky 13 Garage is your one-stop shop for cold beer, great music and awesome friends. Situated at 8 Cochrane's Road, Moorabbin, well away from the hustle and bustle of the sea. Lucky 13 Garage is a nice place to relax, dance, socialise, enjoy your weekends the way it used to be. With an eclectic memorabilia on the walls, suspended from the rafters, professional sound system, comfortable seating, it is truly a unique venue in the Melbourne live scene. For more info, head across to www.lucky13garage, that's lucky13garage.com.au. Rob, Irene and the rest of the gang look forward to seeing you soon.
Just as the leaves are starting to fall, so too is the auction hammer at Hodges Mentone, where record buyer demand is fueling high property prices. So if you're looking to engage a hard-working team to get a great result when it comes to selling your home, contact Jason at Hodges Mentone on 9584 6500 or drop by our office in Florence Street. Hodges Mentone, your Bayside real estate expert with a genuine interest in your success. Southern FM sponsor.
For more information about the station that rocks your nation, check out www.southernfm.com.au.
You're listening to The Space Show, and we're in a two-hour special from 6 until 8 p.m. tonight with the arrival of the Rosetta spacecraft at the comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko, otherwise known as 67P, the 67 meaning the year it was discovered. Now, we have a little feature here from the European Space Agency about the historical background to this mission. It's not the first time that the European Space Agency has sent a spacecraft past a comet. This is the first time that it's gone into, or is going to go into, orbit around it and then land on it. And also, the Rosetta will follow the comet for at least a year to come. So here's this little feature from the space agency about the background to it.
Once upon a time, a spacecraft called Rosetta and her brother Philae set off on an adventure, a long, long journey to visit a comet called 67P, Churyumov-Gerasimenko. Their journey was inspired by stories they had heard from grandfather, Giotto. Long, long ago, men and women on Earth gazed in wonder at comets that appeared in the sky. What were these mysterious objects? Some thought they might be caused by Earth breathing into the sky, but no one knew for sure. Until a Danish astronomer named Tycho Brahe discovered that comets are very far away, much, much further from Earth than the Moon. How could we learn more about these distant objects? By trying to get close to them. I was one of the lucky spacecraft to fly very close to the most famous comet of all, Halley's Comet. Halley's Comet is very special. It is named after Edmund Halley, who discovered that many comets come back regularly to our sky. He predicted that one of those comets would return after 76 years. And it did. Time and time again, Halley's Comet has come back right on schedule every time. The last time, in 1986, I was there. Together with a bunch of friends from lots of other countries, we set off to welcome this legendary comet. I was the bravest of all and flew less than 600 kilometers from the comet's nucleus. It was a harsh place, but the sight was amazing, and I sent pictures back home. Many more spacecraft have gone looking for comets after us, like your cousin Stardust, who flew by comet 81P Vilt, collected dust particles from the shiny tail, and sent them back home to be studied. Or one of your other cousins, Deep Impact, who made a crater in comet 9P Temple to see what's under the surface. Stardust flew by this comet a few years later to look at this famous crater. We have learned a lot about comets, but much more is still to be discovered. Comets hold many secrets about the early days of our solar system. How did planets form? How did water arrive on Earth? And you, Rosetta and Philae, are going to find out by doing what no space probe has ever attempted. Orbit a comet and land on it. Now it's time to write your story. With a historic mission ahead of them, Rosetta and Philae traveled for 10 years. They've been dreaming of comets and the adventure that lay ahead, and they're about to reach their destination. But that's another story.
Yes, it certainly was another story. And we are going to have more about the comet in a few moments, but first we have back with us again Peter Arwood, President of the Space Association of Australia. Welcome again, Peter.
Good to be here, Andrew. It was a very historic evening, so I'm really glad I was able to make it.
Great. And tomorrow, the Space Association is doing more about this.
That's right. We've got our monthly meeting, which is normally scheduled on the first Thursday of each month, and this month it falls on, tomorrow night, the 7th of August. We've got a packed program as usual. We've got a look back at our Apollo 11 45th anniversary, which happened on the 20th of July. And then we've got one of our members went up to Canberra to celebrate that event, that celebration with the people, the tracking guys up in Canberra that were involved in the mission from Tidmanbilla, Honeysuckle Creek, and also Parkes. We've also got a wrap-up of space news. Of course, we're going to be giving you the latest, very latest updates on Rosetta, and you'll be able to see those videos and things that you weren't able to see via the radio tomorrow night, so we'll have that on the big screen. We're also going to look back at, look at a couple of other projects, which is a project that was undertaken by some non-NASA people where they got permission from NASA to reboot an old spacecraft, actually got it fired up and running and fired its engines, but there's a bit of a story there, so we'll have a look at that.
Which, if I remember correctly, actually went past Comet Halley.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Yeah, that's right. So we've got a very comet-busy event this week. We're going to take a look at a movie that's come out, or it's been released, called The Last Man on the Moon, which is about Gene Cernan. And he was the commander of the Apollo 17 mission back in 1972. And, of course, we're going to make sure that we have time to have a chat. So a lot of people enjoy getting together, having a chat, where you can have a nice meal down at the OPRSL. The meeting starts at 7 o'clock, but you can come in a bit earlier and order a meal or have the meal during the meeting. We're quite happy for that to happen. And we normally wrap up about 9:30, 10 o'clock, and then they kick us out and we keep talking in the car park for another hour. So it's normally a good fun evening.
Yeah, and don't worry if you can't rock up on time. Just come in. We're a friendly bunch, and so we know that people can't always make 7 o'clock, so 7:30, 8 o'clock, whatever.
That's right. And the meetings are free. You're more than welcome to come along, bring the kids, being granddad or grandma, or come along. We're pretty friendly people, and it's usually a fun night for everybody.
Well, thank you, Peter. Peter Arwood, Space Association Australia, and we'll be back in a moment.
Where today's community news makes conversation, the Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
Now, Peter, your impressions of the events of this evening. You've been here with us. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I didn't quite know what to expect, and I think they did a really good job of depicting what was going on. It's always difficult, I suppose, when something's so far away, the signals will take 20-odd minutes to get to Earth. And they don't have a physical landing per se, but they've achieved the objective, which is the main thing, which is to get a parallel course with the comet, which is the major stepping stone to achieving the final objective of going to orbit around the comet and then also landing the Philae lander on it. So for us space geeks, it's great. For those general public people, probably a little bit dry, but it's a fascinating fascinating project, and wonderful that something that's taken so long to come to fruition, to be built, to be launched, and then to be in space for that long and still to be functioning. It's a testament to the design, the imagination, the skill, and the cooperation of the European Space Agency.
Just reminding people that it was launched in 2004, March the 2nd, and it was actually intended to be launched a year earlier and go to a comet Wirtanen, but the Ariane rocket that was launched before, one of the earlier spacecraft, it blew up not long after launch.
Right.
And so, they had to go back to the drawing board and resync the Ariane 5 rocket and do a few design changes. And then, of course, by that time, Wirtanen had been and gone, and it was no longer possible to rendezvous with that, so they chose another comet. And as it turns out, this one is absolutely amazing. Now, you've seen the pictures, Peter. Give our listeners a verbal description of what your impression of that comet is.
Okay, it looks like two snowballs, one larger, one smaller, and then sort of slammed together with a connecting sort of lump in the middle, so
a neck, it's sometimes been called.
A neck, yes. Yeah. It's a lumpy, sort of very deformed potato. So, but as the pictures are coming in, they're getting higher and higher resolution. You're seeing more and more detail on it, and it looks extremely rocky and rough. And so they're going to have a challenge to actually find a landing spot for the lander.
Yes, because being such an odd shape, the gravity field would be very distorted. And very weak, I might add. And so as the Philae drifts down, it could be pulled to the side by the larger lump.
Yeah, I think so. I suspect that what they'll probably do is go for the bottom of the largest lump with the flattest sort of area but who knows?
The danger of that is, of course, that's the part that's spinning the fastest.
Oh, right, okay.
And that might present some problems as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's going to be a very interesting few months while they decide where to land and the composition, because the neck part seems to be a lot dustier than the rest.
Okay. Well, they need a little rover, don't they?
Well, the thing is, they want to get some samples. So they've got a little drill on the lander.
Right.
That will drill down and get a sample of the, I'll call it soil, although it's not soil, of the regolith is the proper name for it. And they don't want just dust. They want to get some of the ice and stuff to see what it's made of.
Yes, right.
So it's going to be an interesting time ahead.
Any idea how deep it drills?
I can't remember offhand, but it's about 20 centimetres or so.
Okay, that's a reasonable depth anyway.
Yeah.
Well, that should be interesting. Should be fascinating.
Mm. And they'll have to sort of anchor it to the spinning comet.
Yes.
Because otherwise it'll just... Imagine a child on a little merry-go-round, you know, and you let go and the child goes flying off. So they've got to hang on. By the way, the comet rotates once every 12 hours.
Okay. Well, it's not too fast, but...
Yeah, it's several hundred metres across this comet, and they have to, you know, anchor it, especially if they get at the end, which is spinning the fastest. So, yeah, curious dynamics.
Yeah, I mean, I assume they would have anticipated that rotation when they designed the vehicle, but very difficult to know what speeds that they would be encountering. I suppose it's all about orbital mechanics. Once you match that rotation, it doesn't really matter. It's the relative distance, relative differences in speed that will get you.
Mm. Well, today they're 100 kilometres away from the nucleus, and they will, over the next few months, bring it down closer and closer until they're only 10 kilometres away, and then they'll drop, I'll use that word, drop the Philae lander down, and it'll sort of almost float down very gently. Now, it's interesting that the Neo Shoemaker spacecraft landed on an asteroid which was shaped like a kidney bean, or sort of a almost like a banana in some ways. And it presented interesting gravitational problems, and it drifted down so gently. It wasn't designed to land, and it drifted down so gently, it landed on the side with the solar panels still intact.
Right.
Now, the solar panels are pretty fragile, and you can imagine landing on them. Oh, no, it landed there okay and transmitted for a while from the surface.
Mm. And the Japanese landed one too, didn't they?
Yes. That was a bit different. They took Hayabusa to Comet Itokawa, which, again, was sort of lumpy at two ends and a bit of a thin, bit thinner in the middle. And, again, its gravity field was quite complex. And they actually tried to land a little mini rover on the comet, on the asteroid. And, unfortunately, they released it. Well, Hayabusa was moving away, and so the little rover never made it to the surface.
Oh.
But they did drop several other markers on the asteroid, and they successfully touched down, and we used as markers to think. Then the main spacecraft came down, touched the comet, fired a marble, sort of ball bearing, into the surface, collected some dust, and then moved away and did that twice, and then put the samples into a capsule and then returned to Earth after a great deal of trouble and landed in
Australia
at the Woomera Prohibited Range. So there we go. Interesting times.
I wonder if they're going to play that music out of 2001 when they do that rendezvous with the comet. You know, in 2001 with the spacecraft and the space station rendezvous.
That would be something. I don't have it queued up here. What I do have here, which I don't have time to play tonight, but I'll just tell people about it, is some music that was written for Halley's Comet.
Oh, yes.
Here in Melbourne. It was performed here in Melbourne, and it's by the White Light Orchestra. Halley's Comet, and it runs for 40 minutes, so I can't play it tonight. Because we are almost out of time here on The Space Show. You have been listening to a Space Show special from 6 p.m. this evening, right through until just a few seconds time, and we are back next Wednesday at 7 o'clock with some of the news about Rosetta, plus other things that have been happening. There's some announcements about Mars coming up, and by the way, NASA's just announced the Mars 2020 rover instruments, so that's something to talk about in next week's show. But right now, we're going to be handing over to Mark Norman and his wonderful program, Purple Haze. I'm Andrew Rennie, and I've been with Peter Arwood. The Space Show, back next week.